Brad, normally when you get a rental car, you know, they're like, all right, Mr. Kellett, your Toyota Tercel is waiting for you outside, or your Camry, or your Ford Taurus, or, you know, your standard boring sedan is waiting for you out in the parking lot. Here's your little insurance thing, and there you go. There's your keys. Brad and I fly into Oakland, California, and we're going to drive up to Santa Rosa for the Schultz Museum. And Brad goes out to collect the car, and waiting for Brad is a car perfectly assigned to Brad Geiger's personality, his look, his entire demeanor. Brad, what was it?
It was a white 4x4 Toyota Tacoma pickup truck. And this thing was a behemoth.
It was huge.
I got to tell you, I was a little bit intimidated by this truck because I learned how to drive on a Chevy Econovan.
Right? Okay.
I can drive a bigger car, a minivan. Certainly, I've driven in the past. My Mazda is nowhere near as big as this. But that's the first time I've driven anything that big for any amount of time. And I was I couldn't even get into the truck. You ever go to a dude ranch and you see that guy that maybe he's got a couple extra pounds on him that's trying to get into the horse? He's got his foot in the stirrup. He's got to keep hopping and hopping and hopping until he finally hops. That was me. Every time trying to get into that Tacoma.
The anticipatory hop to get into onto the horse is such a perfect idea because you and I are not in tip-top shape, and it's this raised Tacoma with these giant tires. By the way, why is this car in rotation for a rental company? It's the weirdest thing.
I have no idea.
So Brad and I, every morning, we're trudging out to the car with coffee in hand, and then we kind of have to get a running start to get up into the truck because it's gigantic.
And getting out was just as bad. It was like hopping out of the top bunk of a bunk bed.
Oh, I know. Gravity was doing all the work when I would get out of that truck. It was like, here I go! Watch how fast I move! But I gotta tell you, watching Brad Geiger drive this truck from like 14 feet up in the air was an absolute delight. It was because by hook or by crook, my plane logistics were a little bit weird, so I wasn't able to put my name on the rental. So Brad was the only one that could drive us, and he had to drive us all weekend, and it was amazing to watch you drive around Santa Rosa, California, just never having driven a 4x4 truck before. It was great.
Well, and part of it, I'm gonna insist the brakes were a little grabby. The brakes were a little touchy. So like I would just touch.
Oh my God, Brad would do, so you guys know how when you go to brake and it's a tap and then you slow down and then you're braking, right? And then you've come to a complete stop. Brad would do the quadruple tap where you're like, oh God. And each time the seatbelts would lock up on my innards. And I think I might need a new kidney. I'm not sure what's going on down there. Like, I don't process liquids anymore. Something happened. The best, though, because I couldn't get CarPlay working on the navigation for the thing, we had to do the kind of old couple thing where I'm holding the map, in this case my phone, and like describing where to turn. And I'm not a great navigator. I'm just going to say it out loud. Brad, also not a great driver. And so what this is the phrase that stands out for me on the trip as we're driving through an intersection, and I just hear from Brad, sweetie, you gotta tell me if that's the turn. Sweetie, you gotta tell me before the turn.
Yeah, I couldn't think about what I was saying, and by the way, my wife, complete vindication, because I'm telling her this story, and she's like, finally, somebody understands what I've been putting up with for over 25 years, because that's she's always trying to navigate, and I have no sense of direction, and I'm constantly saying these phrases to her, so I think it's part of the sentence now. Sweetie, you gotta tell me before the turn. Here's another one that she does that I love. She'll say, turn this way. Well, and then she points, and I can't see which way this way is. I'm like, sweetie, use your words. You got to tell me left or right.
Well, I got to tell you, for somebody who thinks visually, you are a cartoonist.
Yeah.
You spend your day drawing images, right? I thought it was a natural that we would be good with our spatial awareness, but Brad, we're driving along and Brad's like, okay, so this is, we're trying to get back to the hotel. He's like, so this is the right, right? And I go, Brad, no, it's a left. And he goes, and then I go straight. No, you U-turn. Okay, but then I go towards the big building, right? No, you drive away from the big building. I've never seen someone with a worse sense of direction. You would have ended us up down in San Francisco had it just been left up to you.
Oh, yeah. I would have never gotten there. I've been driving my kids to the same place for practice for years. They've been participating in this choir for years. And I have to turn the map on every time because I know I'll miss a turn. I've got zero sense of direction. No awareness at all.
Well, I'll tell you what. I know the direction we're going in today. So I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
That was a beautiful transition. And making a living from comics, I'm Brad Geiger, the author of the Webcomics Handbook and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his traveling pal, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And a reminder to everybody that we have a fantastic new sponsor to welcome to the Comic Lab family. Oh boy, are we excited to have them on board because they are actually used to host Comic Lab Comics. Brad, DreamHost is our sponsor this week.
Yeah, I can't be more excited about this. I've been using DreamHost for years and years and years. And we've been talking on the show about the importance of having your own website, and we've really been ramping that up as we see Twitter go up in flames. This is the time to make your move.
Yes.
And these are the folks to do it with. DreamHost at DreamHost.com. If you go to DreamHost.com/comiclab, all one word, you're going to see they've got a couple of hosting plans that are impossible to beat. They advertise transparent pricing and a 100% uptime guaranteed. The shared starter plan starts at $2.59 a month. The shared unlimited plan starts at $3.95 a month. And there's all kinds of add-ons and all kinds of benefits that go along with both of those. I want you to go over there and take a look at it and see for yourself. But things like a free domain included, WordPress pre-installed, yes, which is super, super useful, adding email addresses, very, very super useful, DreamHost. And again, the fact that I've been using them for so long, I can look you right in the eyes and tell you, I think you should be using DreamHost for your host because, and I've told the story before, I never get tired of telling it. The few times I have a little bit of a problem, and usually it's because of something old Brad did. Every time I created a mistake for myself, I put a support ticket in, I get a response right away, and you can tell you're getting a response not from a chat bot, not from an algorithm. You're dealing with a person, and every time they've gotten me right back up on my feet, got going, and a lot of times made things better than when I started that day. They'll do a little tweak here, a little fix there. I'm telling you, you cannot work with a more enjoyable group of people than DreamHost. They really are the best. And this is the time. We're heading into the new year, Dave. This is the time when people make New Year's resolutions. If you think your New Year's resolution might be putting up a new website and getting going in that direction, these are the folks to do it with. DreamHost.com/comiclab will get you started.
Once again, that is DreamHost.com/comiclab. Head over there right now. Check it out. Check out the pricing. Type it in. DreamHost.com/comiclab. We have a really big show coming off of our Santa Rosa trip to the Schultz Museum, which was an absolute delight. And we so thank everyone that came out. We'll talk more about that later in the show. But I want to tell you, Brad, we got a big week of questions for this week of Comic Lab, and I'm going to jump us right into it to get us going here. So this joke comes in from this question comes in from Leander and writes, "Ahoy, gentlemen, a quick question this time. How do you determine if a joke has enough legs to become a running gag? As an example, I recently created a new character for my strip, shared and tagged on the Discord server for Comic Lab. By the way, an amazing resource if you haven't joined us over at patreon.com/comiclab. Which, anyway, Leander says, as an example, I recently created a new character for my strip, which I believe might be such an idea. Is it just an intuitive thing, or might be some handy dandy metric? So, Brad, how do you know when a joke has enough legs to become a running gag?
Wow. Okay, I'm going to say it's got two concepts are really important here.
Okay.
The first one is the strength of the gag, right? In other words, a running gag has got to be set up so that it's so strong that you don't have to keep explaining it in the intro, right?
Right.
If I've got to re-explain the concept, then it's not a great, it's not going to make for a good running gag. Let's take an example from webcomics. Scott Kurtz had a running gag about the panda attack.
Right.
All right.
Right.
A very simple, clear, understandable running gag that this would be a random thing that would happen. All of a sudden, the panda attacks. He didn't have to explain it or re-explain it. It kind of went without explanation.
Yes.
And I think the first thing your concept has to do is to be so either powerful or simple that you don't have to explain it, because the problem with a running gag is that you risk throwing something out there that the person goes, oh, what was that? And then you go, oh, you had to read the strip from last March, and then you'll understand it because it's a running gag and it started
right.
in March.
Right.
Well, that you don't want that. And I'm going to argue that in today's day and age, the second thing that you have to have going for you is a large enough audience that is being carried by the audience. In other words, if you've got a very small audience, this is not the time to start a running gag, because there's not enough people there that will have picked up on the fact that this is a running gag. I think you need to have a certain level of an audience first, because let's also remember, a lot of these concepts like running gags are holdovers from the newspaper days of cartooning, when you had a captive audience. So like Dagwood running into the mailman, that was a running gag because your captive audience was exposed to it over and over and over again.
Right.
We've left the idea of a captive audience. We've got a scrolling audience. So they may have just scrolled past you. They may have just spent a second. They're not out there memorizing your comics because they've got so many things that they're exposed to on a given day. They're not a captive audience. If you want to have a running gag, I'm going to argue a little bit that you should be very careful, because that's a concept that was born of newspaper comics and captive audiences. And it's going to be harder for you, not impossible, but harder for you to do that today.
Well, I will counter by saying all that is excellent advice on this one, is that I agree with you about captive audiences. I agree with you about the way to handle it in terms of it being memorable. I will say this, though, that I come at this from a different angle, which I think is it all comes down to, are you enjoying it? I often think I'm writing the comic strip for me and I'm sharing it with people rather than writing it for other people. I'm writing it for me. And at this point now, after 25 years of cartooning, I have come to trust when I found something, you know, and I sort of know it, like, as you said, Leander, intuitively. Now, that doesn't mean it always works. That's the thing. 25 years, I have gone with running gags that did not work. I've gone with running gag characters, which is a version of a running gag that should not have been kept around. I've also accidentally stumbled on things, and I realized people love them so much that I was like, you know what? I have joy in my heart. I'm not dead inside. I'll go with this running gag, where clearly there was a reaction. I think I've mentioned it before on the show. I had a bird character named Pickles, who I love, don't get me wrong, I wasn't going to do a runner with it, but people like that bird so much that I was like, you know what, why not lean into it? You know, in the same way that it's like when you're giving someone a back rub and they go, oh, that's a great spot. You had no idea, but why not be nice to them, you know? And so you just keep focusing on that spot. The same thing is kind of true with a running gag. Sometimes you're doing your daily work about stuff and a new character, you know, really ricochets with the audience. Or a gag really ricochets. And you're like, you know what? Why not lean into it? They're enjoying it. It's just like giving a massage. It sounds creepy now that I keep bringing
up. Boy, do you ever want a back rub over there? Listen, somebody in the Los Angeles zip code, hustle over there and start rubbing this guy's shoulders. Holy moly.
Brad's texting my wife, will you hug your husband for God's sake?
just give him a little hug.
Anyway, so I personally feel like it's a mix of intuition, and also because remember that when you're feeling the joy, the audience is feeling the joy. So if I'm really enjoying, I don't know, a talking couch that I've introduced, and I've got no emails about it, I've got no tweets back, I've got no comments on Instagram, but I know I'm enjoying it, why not lean into it? It's not like I'm ending my cartooning tomorrow. I've got decades of more to do ahead of me. So why not do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 jokes on the couch, right? Who cares? And the other thing is, like I said, when an audience leans into it, let the joy infest your heart, too. You put out the character or the joke in the first place. If people really responded to it, stay in that moment. That's perfectly fine, I think. You don't need to run away from it when it's happening.
Yeah, Dave, I kind of agree with you. I think all of that fits into the mix. And by the way, with this kind of stuff, it's always about balance, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to take into account, you've got to do this and follow your gut as a writer. And at the same time, you've got to be listening to your audience and gauge their reaction.
Right, you're not in a vacuum.
And let's face it. Yeah. Sometimes you're going to be leaning on one side. Sometimes you're going to choose wrong and you're going to throw something out there that you thought was going to really connect and it doesn't. And that happens. And sometimes you're going to choose right and find something that just absolutely is compelling.
Well, I thought I was wrapped up, but now I want to add a bumper to your bumper, which is one of the reasons why I said err on the side of if you're enjoying it, keep doing it is over the course of my 25 years of cartooning, 5,000 Sheldon, I have definitely leaned into running gags or running characters that I shouldn't have. Right. But the fact is it kept my joy level up. So I kept cartooning, you know, and there's something to that. So, again, it's just another way of looking at it, that it's good to err on the side of your own intuitive editorial eye for your cartooning.
Absolutely. So, Dave, we've got another question that comes in from a Patreon backer and a member of the Comic Lab community who says, I'd like to ask your opinions on using 3D exclusively for a webcomic. What we mean is everything will be modeled in 3D software and then rendered with cell shading to make it look cartoony. There are people who don't seem to mind the use of 3D and others who call it lazy. As always, your opinions are greatly appreciated and your podcast is invaluable. So, Dave, we're talking about the concept of using 3D software, putting a filter on it like cell shading to make it look a little bit more hand drawn.
Right.
If not, you can't really go 100% hand drawn, I wouldn't imagine. But they're trying to give it a cell shaded look to make it look a little bit more cartoony. They're worried because some people call it lazy.
So my bigger concern traditionally with 3D posed art has always been the sort of uncanny valley that it tends to fall in.
Yeah.
Especially with faces. And it's absolutely the limitations of 3D rendering art at the moment, which seems to always create sort of a, what was the winter train movie that Zemeckis made?
The Polar Express.
Polar Express.
Tom Hanks doing the voices.
Yeah. And I think Satan himself doing the eye animations, which I think was Polar Express. Oh boy, you'll see that in your dreams tonight. Anyway, so that's kind of the feeling that I get from not all, but a lot of 3D art. And so that tends to be my first hesitation, nothing to do with laziness, but it had a lot to do with the sort of uncanny valley of too near human, but too unlike human in a way that sort of freaks me out. But Brett, what do you think about this idea of 3D art kind of overlaid with more of a hand drawn, maybe more of a cell created look?
Yeah. Even with the cell shading, all of these problems are very prevalent because I've seen a lot of these and I know what this person's talking about. And there's a real problem that develops here. So let's start here. The reason you're using 3D software is probably because you don't know how to draw and you don't want to take the time to learn how to draw.
Right. Or you don't trust your drawing, you know? Yes.
Right. And that's valid. That's fair. And I understand it. There's things that I don't know how to do and that I don't want to take the time to learn.
Right.
And that I know I'm not good at, like coloring. And that's why I hire a colorist,
because
I know this isn't in my skill set. It doesn't come naturally to me. Mm-hmm. And to take the time to learn how to do it well would be detrimental.
Agreed.
So I understand that whole thing. But there's one problem there, and that is this. You haven't developed a visual aesthetic to make good decisions with your 3D software. So let's talk about that.
Oh, interesting thinking. Yeah. Keep going with that. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah, I've got, so there's two things you got that I, there's two things that I always see in 3D software comics. And they're two sides of the spectrum. They swing violently from one side to the other. Here's the first mistake that I see in a 3D comic. You'll have a scene that's set up, for example, right? And because it's using a 3D software, it's got a ton of visual details. And all of the details are almost exactly the same focus. So let's say, for example, you've got a classroom scene. I'll take something that you can easily visualize. Let's say you've got a classroom scene. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you got a bunch of kids in a classroom. Mm-hmm. So in the foreground, maybe you've got a teacher's desk. Every piece of the detail of that teacher's desk, the handles on the drawers, the books on top of the desk, the pencils in a pencil case, is in the exact same focus as the midground, where you've got a bunch of chairs, you know, those chairs that kids sit on, have the little table on them, and they've got the little wire basket underneath. Every detail of the wire basket in the chair is the same detail as the teacher's desk, is the same detail as the kids' jeans, is the same detail as the radiator with the radiator vents, is the same level of detail as the Venetian blinds. Let's say you put some, now let's go to the background. In the way background, you've got a bookcase, a bunch of books, all, the same level of detail.
You can read all
the
titles. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You got posters in the back. You've got a poster of the moon. You can see every crater on the moon. You know? Yeah. You got the Eiffel Tower, every beam of the Eiffel Tower. And since you don't have the visual aesthetic to know how, I'm sorry, bad that looks, and since you can't discern the fact that you've put all of this detail on it and none of it is important, you haven't learned to pick and choose. We haven't even, by the way, this is 1/4 of scene composition. Mm-hmm. We haven't even gotten to the rest, and I'd actually like to talk about the rest, but I'm going to put a pause just for a second. But my point here at this juncture is that because you haven't developed a visual aesthetic, you don't know that all of that visual detail is clutter. And what it's like listening to a radio that isn't quite tuned in and you got static. You can hear the announcer, but there's also all this static.
This is great. And if I can pause you, because I want to hear the rest of your points on this, but I want to pause you to say that cartooning benefited from one of the weirder cause and effects in all of art history, which was cartooning required repetitive schedules and usually single or small team people creating them, right? And so what was the effect of that? The effect of that was a simpler, cleaner line and usually an erring towards iconicity rather than realism, right? And it just so happened that that cause and effect made for really effective storytelling because it reduced down what the eye had to see to what was truly important. So Charlie Brown really works on a totally blank background because the brain wants it to just be Charlie Brown and a totally black name. And the same is true with early Superman. It was just a dude flying against the blue sky. It worked great, you know? Yes. So what I'm saying is, in this case, the historical causes of why comics became more iconic and simpler line also produced an effect that was really powerful. And I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of 3D created comics and a lot of fumetti from the 60s and 70s, which were photo created comics, don't work because the eye doesn't respond as well. The effect of that is that it doesn't respond as well to the visual clutter that is realism. I mean, we all admit that a room can be that full and is that full. And my office, as I'm looking around it right now, is very cluttered. But comics don't work well that way with all that stuff going on. Unless you're trying to create a story of an uncluttered mind, in which case then you have a very cluttered room. But for most comics, that's not the point. That's not the effect you want.
And I would even give Fumetti a little bit of an advantage because a good photographer, by using depth of field, could bring certain things into focus and leave certain things out of focus.
Yes, but Fumetti always has the overdone Italian opera poses where everyone looks like they're Heat Miser walking into a door like, I'm Mr. Heat Miser, I'm Mr. Gold, you know. Like, but they all got the big elbows as they walk into a room. Yeah, they're looking like they're looking like a JCPenney model selling kids clothes, you know, like the little things that you walk with. What are they called? The mannequins. Like, everyone in Fumetti looks overly posed, overly dramatic. And unfortunately, the same thing tends to happen in 3D art too, because kind of what Brad was saying, a lot of people didn't cut their teeth on drawing and drawing and drawing and drawing and drawing. They let they took a cheat and let the art or the artwork software do it for them. Yep. And part of that is not realizing that you're overposing your characters. Not everybody needs to be so imposed all the time. And a lot of 3D art and a lot of fumetti tend to look that way. Anyway, Brad, I keep stepping on your point, so keep going. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. But like I said, that's only a quarter of it. And I'm just going to, without like belaboring the point, there's also scene composition, what Dave kind of touched on, like what's in the foreground, what's in the background, how are you leading the person's eye across that scene? Mm-hmm. So most of the 3D comics I see is just scattered. There's no unifying composition. And as a result, it's just all the characters are just scattered around the scene.
Yeah, sometimes it feels like, look at the assets that I had. I had a table, I had a chair, I had a,
That's exactly what it looks like. And just to like to wrap up this section of it, the other thing that is always terrible in these 3D comics, or almost always, the colors, because they don't have a visual aesthetic. All the colors are super dark, super saturated, super intense. And you'll have, for an example, a kid with a black shirt standing in front of a navy blue chair with dark gray pants and a black floor. And he's got black hair and he's turned away from the camera. So all you see is his neck and the side of his head. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Dark, 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 dark. You can't, since you don't have the visual aesthetic, you're not balancing the colors. You're not thinking about it. You think you push the button, the 3D software doesn't. It looks great on your screen because it's all 3D. It looks like a photograph. But since you haven't developed a visual aesthetic, you don't know that putting a kid in a black shirt standing on a black floor with a dark background and all these dark components all over is creating an imperceptible scene.
Yeah. And maybe if we're giving credit within the context of this question, maybe the cell shading overlay on this will fix that often seen problem, you know? So Brad is enthusiastically agreeing with me on that, that's going to fix the problem.
No, this person mentioned cell shading. So I went and I looked at and tried to find some comics that had exactly this kind of cell shading. And I'll tell you right off the bat, that ain't going to help. It ain't going to solve these problems. Now, I told you about the pendulum. So on one side, you've got a super cluttered image. You've got a super intense with colors and backgrounds that bleed into foregrounds that bleed into midgrounds. You've got all those clutter. Now, in the next panel, you'll see them swing all the way over to the other side, and they'll have this perfectly modeled foreground, a foreground character, a little kid going to school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for the background, in front of this perfectly modeled 3D character, the background, solid gray or white.
Right, white.
No. No gradation, no note, no alteration of the color tone, just a solid gray. And since you haven't developed a visual aesthetic, you don't know how bad that looks. You don't know how much that doesn't work. I've seen some of them. They'll choose two intense RGB colors like RGB red and RGB green, and they'll do a gradient between one and the other, a graduation tone that goes from that blue to the green. So then at least some of the colors are changing. But of course, that's pretty bad too. The problem is sometimes they're smart enough to take the background out because they feel like that is too complicated. And then the background you put in there, since it doesn't exist in that 3D modeled space, it looks off and the person just looks like they're floating there.
Right, right.
So I know what you're saying. But Brad, how do I develop my visual aesthetic? And the answer is, and you're going to hate it, learn how to draw, because that's how you build your visual aesthetic, is by making 1,000, 10,000 bad drawings with your hand or with your however you're drawing, finger painting, I don't care. By making all of these bad drawings by you creating them, starting with a blank page and putting a line on that page and another line and another line, by doing that over and over again, making mistakes, learning from trial and error, that's how you build a visual aesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to be a lot more difficult. I'm sure you could still do it, but I think the road is going to be longer. And the absolute truth of it is that if your writing is good, it doesn't matter that you're doing 3D software. If the writing is good, you could do a stick figure and make that communicate just as well. If you're worried about learning how to draw, you could do it with a stick figure if the writing is good. But my problem is I've been asked to look at these 3D comics a few times by different people, and the visuals are so bad, I've never been able to actually read it because I nope out by the third panel. And I'm like, nope, I'm not reading this. Forget about it. Not going to happen. But you want to develop your visual aesthetic? Honestly, I'm going to say my opinion is to learn how to draw.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I want to say one harsh thing and then a couple of positive things on this. One is, for whatever, and this is my subjective take on it, is that for the most part, I feel like no one has yet figured out how to crack the nut properly in terms of creating 3D comics that are compelling, visually interesting, standalone-ish, and jump out at me as a comic that works, right? But again, that's just me subjectively. There might be, and there are entire communities online that love both Fumetti, something that I said I don't like, 3D comics, something that I said I don't like, posed Lego comics, something that I said I don't like in the past. Mm-hmm. There are communities that love all three of those. They're just not for me. So I'm saying that's a subjective, and if it works for you, then go with God. That's great. It's getting you creative. Because the ultimate point that I want to say here is that you said, is it lazy to create this way? And I will tell you that the truly lazy thing in life to do is to not create comics. You are on a path. Wow. You are creating. And so in some respects, to hell with whatever criticism Dave and Brad are saying, you're figuring something out that's working for you, that's got you on a path of creating. And if it's keeping you creating, then keep at it, because maybe you'll be the one that really, really cracks the nut on 3D comics. I think it is, if we're being honest about it, is a newish form of creating comics. And so much like the first generation of newspaper comics around the turn of the century, they didn't quite figure it out yet. You look at a yellow kid and you're like, a lot of this doesn't work. And, you know, Cats and Jammer Kids, a lot of that doesn't work. But it took them a couple decades and they figured it out. And maybe you will be among the cartoonists that really figure out how to make 3D comics compelling and interesting and just enough iconicity in there, as Brad and I were saying, with enough simplicity and clarity of communication to really work. So my lasting thought is, no, it's not at all lazy. The true lazy thing is to do nothing. You are doing something. And for that, I commend you.
No, I couldn't agree with you more on that. You're out there doing something. And the other part is, it's hard to get worse at something you do every day. Yes. So if you're out there and you're learning from your mistakes and making it, then you're going in the right direction. And quite frankly, I'm just going to throw out another option. There is that you can take those, set up those 3D scenes, and then use those as a basis to draw from.
That's
true. You
can
use those as almost a sketch to draw from. And now you're making those decisions. Like, is it important that we see the handles on the teacher's desk? Not really, you know, so I'm going to leave that visual information out, but I'm going to include this visual information. And by making all those choices, you can create a much better scene. But lazy, nobody can call you lazy.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
So a quick update for everybody mid-show. We just came back from a fantastic talk at the Charles M. Schulz Museum in Santa Rosa, California, and it was a delight. And we had people flying in from Utah, from Philadelphia, from Southern California, from the state of Washington, from Ohio, from Colorado. And I got to tell you, it was wonderful that people came from all over the world. In this case, America being the world. Like, we didn't have any Canadians or Mexicans. But anyway, from all over to come join us. But here's what it did. It did for us. It sparked in us a desire to do more of these public talks and to bring the podcast around the world here. So this is a first solicitation. If you are a place of learning, if you are a museum, I'm looking at you, Ohio State. I'm looking at you, Smithsonian. I'm looking at you, SCAD. I'm looking at you, SVS. We would love to come do a public recording of the podcast. So we've got a whole list of topics we can talk about. One of our favorites might be the idea of, Brad, you speak to it better.
Oh, yeah.
The
idea of creativity. We were talking about this in the truck, but we were in the truck talking about this. Somewhere between some of the screams and the whimpers, we said, you know...
And the sweeties, you got to give me the directions ahead of time. Sweeties,
somewhere
just
in the
having
middle of
Brad
all of
in
that.
A diminishing way call you sweetie is so hilarious.
Somewhere in there, I said, you know, one thing that we could talk about, like if that wasn't completely comic centric, one kind of general topic that we could talk about that would be compelling would be creativity on demand. Yep. In other words,
yes.
Like we've talked about in the past, people approach creativity kind of backwards. They wait for the muse to come and shine on them. They wait for an idea to fall. And as people that did daily comic strips for well over a decade, the both of us, we had to come up with an idea every day for year after year after year. Going over 10 years, we had to come up with a new idea every day. And we could talk about this concept of making creativity happen and changing the way we look at creativity away from a waiting, searching mode to a problem-solving mode. And I'm telling you, I think that would be a compelling hour if we just talked about creativity on demand.
Yeah. So universities, museums, corporations, we're looking at you. We would love to bring this show once to the East Coast every year, once to the West Coast every year.
Yeah.
We think it would be a super fun thing to do. So give us a holler if it's something you're interested in. We are actively putting together our pitch for it right now.
Dave, could the Comic Lab TED Talk be far behind?
I mean, listen, no, the answer is no. I think that idea of the two of us with a little wireless mic up on stage, you know, pronouncing back and forth.
Yes,
we're ready for our close up, Mr. DeMille. Yes.
So speaking of the Charles M. Schulz Museum in sunny Santa Rosa, California, this is one of the people that we met. This question comes in from Lisa. We met out in Santa Rosa, who says, in the Pro Tips episode number 252, Brad talks.
252.
We're getting zeroed right in here. There's no no generalities. Brad talks about using hard returns for your text in the word balloons to help the sentence read naturally. And then he just touches on how the sentence actually looks within the balloon. I know that you both place a large value in the negative space around the text. That's the space between the words and the outer line of the word balloon. We always say that that interior border has to be consistent. So between the hard returns to make the sentence read properly and keeping a consistent border inside your word balloon, Lisa would like to know, which is more important? Is it getting the sentence to read right or keeping that border consistent?
Well, I'm going to give you an answer, Lisa, that will be perhaps unsatisfying, because the true art of lettering is to kind of land both those planes at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that it always happens. Lord knows, I've been lettering now forever with hand lettering and then digitally lettering with Drive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always happen, but you want to try as much as possible to both have the hard returns land in natural places in an English sentence. And English can be kind of broken up into chunks that sort of make sense in the way you break it up, right? But every once in a while, you're going to have a weird long word like mononucleosis or something. And you have to try to figure out, why did that word pop into my head? But you're going to have a long word. And really what's probably going to happen is you're probably going to have to put on your writer's hat and think of an alternate word or think of a different way to structure it, because there's no good way to line break with a giant word like disambiguation or something, you know, and you're going to have to figure out a new way to say it. So, I will say that 90% of the time, what I try to do is frankly rewrite it until I have both the strong line breaks and the overall shape of the sentence work together to create a cohesive unit that has as much as a consistent space all around the word balloon and also flows right in the way that you read it. Brad, how about you?
Yeah, I agree 100%. You've got it. That sentence has to read right. And the interior border has to be somewhat consistent. It's got to be as consistent as you can make it. And I absolutely, Dave, have rewritten a sentence or rewritten some dialogue so that it fits better. And I've chosen a different word or went to different direction or broken up the that sentence in a different way. I've absolutely done that. I've used that strategy. I've also used this strategy. Sometimes you can do what I call docking. That's when you kind of push the word balloon up against the border of the panel in such a way that it gets chopped off. Now, I realize that I'm talking
about... You call about that docking, huh? I like that.
I call that docking because you're docking it right in there. Now, since that's a visual, I know it's hard for you to understand, but we have a book that is, I think, one of the best books on the subject. The comic book lettering book, Essential Guide to Comic Book Lettering by Nate Picos. If you turn your hymnals to page 132, he's got an example there of what I'm talking about. And I'm talking about the right hand illustration under the subheading balloons placed within panel borders. That's what I call docking. And it can often get you out of a ticklish situation where you just can't get it to line up, or you can't keep that border consistent, and you just can't rewrite that sentence anymore. I've used docking to cheat my way. Well, it's not quite Kobayashi Maruing my way out of it, but it comes darn close. So go to page 132 in the Essential Guide to Comic Book Lettering. Look at the right-hand illustration, and you'll get a great way to get yourself out of a tight spot.
First of all, I'm here for it anytime you're able to work Kobayashi Maru into a sentence. Traveling this weekend with Brad, I'm realizing he uses it anytime he can, and it's delightful. Like ordering breakfast with Brad, he's like, I'm going to figure out a way to Kobayashi Maru half of the plate from this order, half. And I'm like, why did you use Kobayashi Maru? I'm here for it, though.
It's just fun to say. Kobayashi Maru, it's got all the little syllables, all the little bouncing vowels. It's a great word.
There's a flow to Kobayashi Maru that's just fun. Anyway, so I've got a couple other things I can tell you, Lisa, with this, because it's an imperfect science. It is an art to try to get both the lettering to flow for natural flowing language and also to create that smooth and consistent bordering. I will say, if you can't get smooth and consistent bordering, sometimes you have to opt for pleasant bordering, which is a different way of saying it's not going to be consistent, but at least you can make it pleasant. And usually that means a little heavier on the bottom, a little lighter on the top, because most objects in the natural world tend to be heavier on the bottom, like a pyramid, and lighter on the top, right? I would try to avoid any kind of sausage roll or hoagie roll kind of word balloons, because those tend to be visually unpleasant. I will say some other tricks you can do. Sometimes if you have something that's not flowing either with naturally well-reading language or because the bordering is not consistent, what you can do is take a single word balloon, break it up into two. They can be conjoining with the connection missing, or they could be two separate word balloons all pointing down to the same character. That's a very effective strategy. Sometimes you can do what Garfield does. If you notice, Garfield removes the panel on the second panel of Garfield all the time. Mm-hmm. It gives you just an oomph more bit of negative space to work with around a comic. Sometimes that gives you a little bit more space to grow either your word balloon or the shape of your word balloon by getting rid of a panel here and there. Another thing you can do is Some cartoonists in their style will allow for the removal of the word balloon so it's free-floating text. Some styles work with this better. Some backgrounds definitely do not work with this.
Yeah.
Some color schemes definitely don't work with this. But that's another option you can do, because then you don't have to fight that battle. Then it can just be the best hard return and not have to worry about negative space. Brad, any other ideas about what Lisa could do with this kind of situation?
I'm a little bit jealous that you came up with that last one, because I was gonna throw that in there and slam the door on this.
Sorry, I stepped on it then.
No,
I apologize.
No, I'm thrilled that you came up with it, because as you were talking, it's like, yeah, it's the no word balloon. And yep. I'm just going to underline what you said there, because I use that strategy quite a bit. Just remember, you can have no background in that case. In that case, yes. You're doing a foreground. Because again, legibility is key in that situation. Yes. So no background and a light color that's easy to see.
Yes. It's got to be high contrast. Yep.
Yes. Yes. And then I love that.
Married with the other options that we've already given you, which is to rewrite the sentence or to change around the panel design entirely. That's another thing that could be sort of quote unquote rewritten. You could move it from being a busy panel to now it's just a talking head with a much larger balloon that you can now reshape to fit your sizes. All of these options as a toolkit can usually get you to where you want to go. But again, it's not always going to work, in which case I would say opt for the well-broken sentence and a pleasant, if not perfect and consistent negative space around the word balloon.
Absolutely, Dave. So let's talk a little bit more about Kickstarters, because we've got a great Kickstarter question that comes in from a Comic Lab community member over on Patreon, who says, you have said that an unsuccessful Kickstarter is free market research. Once you suspect that a Kickstarter is going to fall short of its goal, do you have any strategies to make the most of that research? Do you just push as hard as you can to see if the goal would have succeeded? Do you give yourself a mental break, ease up on promotion, and just see what happens? Do you cancel the campaign early? Thanks, as always, for your advice and laughs, Chris. So, Dave, you've got a Kickstarter that's about that you've just launched, and you think that it might fail. How do you get the most out of your market research?
Okay, so I think the first way to approach this is to change the way you're thinking about this, because if it's not over, you're not over.
Right.
You still have X number of days. Is it 5? Is it 10? Is it 15? Is it 20 to get to where you want to go? Keeping in mind that the last 5 days of a Kickstarter and the front 5 days of a Kickstarter are the big push, you might be super pleasantly surprised that with the final push, you get to where you want to go. But even if you don't, Brad's idea of free market research is, if I push this with 100% of my oomph, my power, my go, what could I get to? Because then I will know, how much do I need to grow my audience? How much do I need to improve my own Kickstartering? How much do I need to improve my outreach? And so by giving up, which kind of sounds like a lot of the options in this list of questions, you do future you no favors, and you might even be doing present you no favors, because you don't know if you're going to make it. You may yet make it with a Kickstarter that looks like it's failing.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're planning, if you're looking at that Kickstarter and you're in the bottom of that bathtub curve, right, where it is easy to lose heart in the bottom of the bathroom curve. You've gone through the opening day. You had a big boffo open and now things are starting to slow down and you're like, oh, no, I don't think this one is going to make it.
Right.
At that point, if you let that kind of thought to come in, you are actually planning to fail. And if you plan to fail, you're going to succeed at failing. You know, at this point, when you've got your Kickstarter going, you really have to keep your wits about you. We've talked, we devoted a show to good Kickstarter strategy where we said you need to go in like Dave does and make a plan. What I'm going to post every one of those 30 days. Here's what I'm going to, this doesn't happen out of mistake. Dave says, I'm going to do this on this day, this on that day. He's got a spreadsheet. Even if you don't do a spreadsheet, you got to have a mental plan. What I'm going to do each one of those days. If you are devoting thoughts to, I don't think this is going to make it, you've taken your eye off the ball and you're going to fail. I've seen it happen. I saw a guy have a absolute fantastic opening day. Got a huge chunk of where he needed to go on opening day. And a couple days later, he was saying, I think this is going to fail. I think and by the way, it did. Because he was, how do I prepare for failure? Well, let's talk about how do I prepare for success instead, you know? So here, that's something you really, really got to understand is that, number one, everybody gets a little bit despondent in the bottom of the, on the bottom of the basement, in the bottom of the bathtub curve. And you really have to keep your wits about you in a Kickstarter and keep that, keep your eye on the ball the whole time, because if you're even thinking about failing, then you're spending time thinking in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So now I want to tell you why you're not alone. Because every book I've ever Kickstarted succeeded, but every Kickstarter at in the middle of that bathtub curve, and Brad can confirm this, I hated myself. I hated the Kickstarter. I wished I could be doing anything else. I wanted to give up because there's just something about when you go from having 1,000 people back you on day one, 700 people backing you on day two, 50 people backing on day three. And then you get towards the middle of that curve and it's like, I got one person in the world thought my book was, and it can't help but impact you. So I'm with you on that. I have been where you are. I have felt what you were feeling. I also know from my own high school dating career that the way I used to approach asking someone to a dance was like by listing out all the reasons that they wouldn't want to go to a dance with me. Do you know what I mean by that, Brad?
Yes.
Like my high school self was always like, I mean, I'm not as strong as the quarterback, and I don't have the positive vivacious outlook as the drama club, and I'm not as confident as the politicians and student council.
And I couldn't blame you if you said no. I couldn't blame you.
Exactly.
I couldn't blame you if you said no.
A lot of that is outlook. A lot of life is, and listen, older me has this problem too, so I'm not in any way judging. A lot of life is figuring out that you have permission. You can give yourself permission to claim a space for yourself to say, it's okay that I'm doing this thing, and to believe in yourself and say, the art that I'm doing is good art. The comic that I'm making is a good comic. You should read my comic. Yeah. Hey, you should get to know me. Or whatever the context it is. Hey, you should hire me. Whatever the context it is, that you can claim a space for yourself and be a little confident. And I'll tell you, I'm still in middle age and I'm still struggling with that. So it's not, this is not unknown territory to my heart. And I'm sure it's not with Brad. I've seen pictures of Brad in high school and college. So.
I was going to say, what do you mean you're sure? You son of a gun, yeah. But no, so here's the deal. Here's what we're telling you. Plan for success in your Kickstarter.
Yes.
Plan out that 30-day campaign.
Yes.
When you're in the midst of it, keep your head down and follow that plan and give it your all. If you're changing anything, what I want you to do is maybe around day 15 or so, if you see that you're struggling, you don't start planning for failure. How do I get? Basically, what Chris was saying is, how do you have the best possible failure? Right. I reject that.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So instead of saying that, go back and look at what was working in the previous 15 days and do more of that and take a look at what messages were not hitting and just figure out why those messages weren't hitting. Start to come up with some innovations, some new ideas. Here's some things that I hadn't thought of before. The panic makes great inspiration. Right? It's the mother of all inspiration is, oh, shucks, I've got to do this now. So start innovating. That's where you should be putting your all of your energies is to that. Now, if you've done all of that and the Kickstarter misses its mark, then you can go back and do a postmortem and see, you know, what you can learn from it. But the time to try to decide how to have the best possible failure is not during that 30-day period. You've got too much work to do. Keep your eye on the ball.
Yeah. So don't be like Dave Kellett in high school and talk your way out of it while you're trying to ask someone out on a dance. Yeah. I can let you know that it's 100% failure rate when you do that.
100.
So anyway, I'm going to move us on to the next question. It comes in from Mark over at patreon.com/comiclab. And Brad, Mark writes, Instagram is slowly introducing the ability to have more than one link in the account holder's bio. Yeah. Any thoughts on this? Does this or can this change anything related to comics? So I turn this question to Brad, who I believe is number one, maybe number two in the Instagram fan club.
Yes.
So I want to ask you, Brad, what with the idea of a second link in a bio, does this change anything for cartoonist use of Instagram?
So let's take a moment and remember why we hated the Instagram approach to linking. The reason we hated it is because it was separated from the post, that you had to say, yes, link in the bio. And people said link in the bio so often that it lost its meaning. You saw that same, it's kind of like banner blindness. You've been exposed to that message so many times that it loses its meaning. So the right. 1 millionth time you've seen link in the bio, it doesn't even mean anything anymore, right? And,
right.
But even if you do know what it means, you're not going to click all the way over to somebody's bio unless you were really, really compelled, which if that happens, fantastic. I love you. I doesn't happen too often with me. The problem is that you added one more step between them and actually clicking the link. And think of how hard it is to get somebody to click a link. Now give them another step before they got to click that link. It's a terrible system. Is the reason I really am down on Instagram. Now, the question is, hey, you see that whole link that's over there in a bad place that's impossible to get to and sets all of these problems up that you just got done talking about? What if there was two links? Well, it's not about the number of links. It's the fact that the link isn't where it belongs with the post. The link is in the wrong place. I'll tell you what, give me three links. Give me four links. Give me 55 links on my bio page, and it's still the same problem. It's a bad system. It's not set up to make life better for you and me. It's set up to keep you on Instagram. And Instagram, I'll tell you what, Instagram knows that link is so freaking useless. They don't have a single problem. They're going to pretend like they're doing you a big favor. The reason they're putting it there is they also know that it's useless.
Yeah, they know from their own metrics that no one's clicking those, because keep in mind, like Brad said, they've designed their system to keep you in-house. They don't want you leaving. And so it's kind of like this. There's a marathon route, Brad, and everybody's running. All these runners are going by, right?
Yeah.
And you have a table full of cups of water. You want to give them to the runners, except the marathon organizers put you a block away from the marathon.
Yeah.
But now they say, you're not just allowed to give one cup of water. You can give every runner two cups of water. And you're like, well, holy hell, I'm still a block away from the marathon. No one's coming. And so you have this marathon of people coming through your Instagram. No one is actively stopping what they're doing to click into your bio. Like Brad said, but no one's doing these 15 steps to get to this link. Is it nice that there's two links instead of one? Sure, I guess.
Yeah.
But does it help much? No, not at all, really. The one potentially helpful thing that Instagram did was a few years ago when they added link outs from stories.
Yeah.
But even there, I don't find it to be a trampling of people coming, fighting their way to get to my websites or my Kickstarters or my Patreons, whatever it is, Instagram. Because Instagram, let's say it out loud, they've trained their users to stay on Instagram once they're on there. You know, people don't tend to leave. So what does that mean for us? I think it continues to mean for advice from Brad and I that use Instagram if you want, stay on Instagram. It does have the potential to help you reach a percentage of that overall Instagram audience.
Mm-hmm.
I have noticed the one time that it's very helpful is when I say I'm going to a physical location. And then Instagram people will go to the San Diego Comic-Con or to the Schultz Museum or whatever it is. Yeah. They might not click a link, but a percentage. Now, I'm not saying this is a huge number of people. A percentage of people will come up to the booth at San Diego Comic-Con and say, I love your stuff on Instagram. I saw that you were here. I'm so glad. You know, XYZ. But I continue to think that Instagram, if I was starting today, I don't know that I would spend the time, Brad, to build the audience that I did a few years back.
No.
Now I'm just sort of treading water, if I'm being honest about it. I'm not really trying to build on Instagram.
I, as much as I hate to admit it, the only reason I post on Instagram is that I've always been posting on Instagram. And it goes back to that. Don't keep making a mistake because it took you a long time to make it, you know, but it's kind of the only, like, I know that I've got some people to read it on Instagram. I've downgraded Instagram to outgoing messaging only. That unilateral social media that we were talking about. And I just do it because I know some people are out there reading it, and it isn't hard to do. I do it literally at the same time that I'm planning out scheduled Facebook posts, and it's just literally one extra button to click. If I had to spend much more time than that, it would be gone. And that's obviously, we've been talking in the last few episodes about downgrading Twitter to unilateral social media. By the way, we didn't do a Twitter update. Do we want to talk just about what's going on with Twitter?
The Twitter update is just the slow pan of the camera over to a trash can on fire. Is that what we want to say? That's the update? I mean, well, let me talk about this in terms of the update. Because you said the part of the way you're doing Instagram is because you've already been doing Instagram. And so that's the reason why you stay on. And I will tell you, and this is just a public admission of my own, not a failure, but like, I am not sure why I'm doing certain social medias right now, because I genuinely believe that Twitter is going to take it on the teeth in the near future that $1 billion of debt servicing every year, that there's no way, with both advertisers leaving and users, frankly, having a diminished quality of the space. I don't know that they're going to be able to make that money year on year. They might survive the first year because Elon's ego might force him to pay out from his own, selling more Tesla stock, and he'll pay off the $1 billion debt. I don't know. Yeah. But I don't know that he's going to want to do that year on year on year. I don't know that we have many years of this ahead of us. So what I'm getting at is I'm staying on Instagram. I'm staying on Twitter. I don't know, Brad, that it's the best. I guess what I'm saying is I'm admitting to the world, I don't know what my logic is for staying on, other than I'm trying to future proof for future Dave that maybe they'll come back. Maybe they'll find a new way to reconnect with their audience. And so I don't want to have, self-immolated on these platforms.
Yeah.
But I am saying out loud to the public, I don't know why I'm there.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm telling you, right now today we're recording, it's November 15th. I'm not certain that Twitter is going to be here much past 2022. Like I'm not going to be too surprised if it leaves before the new year, that it's just gone. We saw over the weekend that they screwed something up with two-factor authentication. So basically they kept two-factor authentication, but the email that gets sent out or the text that gets sent out that gives you the number, that they stopped. So if you signed out of Twitter, you could not sign back in because you went to two-factor authentication and then that number never came to you. That's the first thing that happened. Second thing, he was talking about this, that, and the next on Twitter. And one of a couple times his own Twitter engineers corrected him, saying, well, what you're saying is not true. I've been working on this for several years, and what you just said is not true. Do you know the outcome of that conversation? That engineer got fired. And I guess there was two different times that has happened. And just to round out the dumpster fire that is Twitter, just as of today, in the middle of November, the latest I'm reading is that Elon Musk wants Twitter to be a bank, right? So what you're going to do is
Chinese messaging service that allows for Alibaba or whatever.
Yeah, you're going to put money into Twitter, and then you can use your Twitter account to buy things. And you can use the Twitter account to get paid. So it's going to be a bank account that you use through Twitter to buy things. It's a bank, like a debit card.
I hope people read the sarcasm in this when I say, if he's able to roll crypto in this, I'm in it in a big way. I'm in, Brad. Say no more. I want Elon, crypto, banking, and Twitter all rolled into one, and I'm in. Yes. I'm in like Flynn. This is a terrible idea.
What was the crypto organization that took major FTX? Crash just this weekend?
Yeah, FTX, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, all the things that I personally hate and recently in the digital world are all falling apart, which is great. NFTs are falling apart. Crypto's falling apart. I love it. But here, the thing about Twitter is we joke around, but here's the thing. There are real world dissidents, real world people fighting for a better world. And the fact is, when you fire half of your engineers from Twitter, you can bet that state actors from Saudi Arabia and Russia and Iran and North Korea are actively trying to get into Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly not as safe as it was two, three, four weeks ago. And so I guess that's another reason why I'm saying, why am I still on Twitter? Not that I have, I'm actively trying to foment revolution in North Korea. I'm just saying, like, it's not as safe as it was a couple weeks ago.
Oh, there's a lot of sources pointing out that Twitter is very hackable right now. And your DMs, your information, your data is among the stuff that is liable to be hacked right now. It's not good. It is not good. We're going to be talking about this in the months to come. There's a lot of us looking at other options.
Well, let me ask you, because I admitted my own insecurity about why am I still on there? Can I ask Brad Geiger, why are you still on Twitter and Instagram?
Same reason, because I've always been there. So Instagram.
Do you see in the near future returns for your time and investment and development of an audience on Twitter and Instagram?
Instagram, no. Twitter, Twitter was an effective social media tool for me, and I used it I'll just tell it's just for an example. I told you I took Twitter off my phone. I took Facebook and Instagram off my phone. So all three of them are off the phone. We're heading out to the lovely Charles M. Schulz Museum, and I've got a 6-hour layover in Las Vegas. Right. And I'm actually proud to tell you, I didn't put a single penny into a slot machine or anything else. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. But there's not a lot to do in the Las Vegas airport if you don't want to be hooked up to that. So I'm like, oh, I should promote the Schulz thing again. Maybe I'll do an Ask Me Anything. I've done that before on Twitter. It's like, hey, I'm sitting here in a waiting room of a doctor's office trying to, you know, pass the time. Ask me anything. And then you sit there and talk. And I had no place to do those things. Right. Because of Facebook, I wasn't going to do it on Facebook. Instagram is a wasteland. I would have spent 6 hours on Twitter before. I would have done another round of promotion. Right. I would have done an AMA. I would have done any number of things. And I used Twitter to great effectiveness in the years that I've been there. And so I've got to keep a heartbeat there, because if it does come back, I'm going to be using it again, because it was effective. It didn't have all those drawbacks that Facebook and Instagram do. So I've got to keep the hope alive that he's not going to ruin it. Because if we do come back from this, then Twitter was my strongest social media.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm being honest about it, my best case hope for Twitter now is that within a few years, a billionaire that I dislike slightly less will buy it out.
Yeah.
Right? That literally is my best case scenario. I mean, frankly, my best case scenario is if a somewhat less bad actor like Google or Apple buys out Twitter, you know, if they see, I could actually see a real strong case for Google's management going, we should buy out Twitter. This is a great family to roll into the Google data set. You know what I mean? Yeah. In terms of how they collect on their users. Is it going to be Peter Thiel? Is it going to be Prince Alawite? I don't know who's going to buy Twitter, but I'm going to like them, I think, slightly less. And so I think that's why I'm staying on Twitter, not because of any particular use I have for it now.
That's just as we're wrapping this up. That's been the big amazement to me, is that Google was not prepared to step in on this. We know they had Google Plus that was supposed to be a Facebook killer. And maybe, if they had made a slightly different version of Google Plus and stuck with it, they would be in a much better place right now. Mm-hmm. But even so, they shut down Google Plus years ago. Wouldn't you think that with all of the resources available at Google, that within a week, they'd say, hey, guess what we're doing? Microblogging. Here it is.
Yeah.
You sign up. You've got your Google account already, because you used it for Gmail or any 9 or 10 other things that you're hooked up to.
Right.
So they got the user base. The fact that they didn't just launch a microblogging software system in the same way that we've seen so many different times. It's like basically Twitter with a different coat of paint on it, because you can't. I don't know that they can patent or copyright the idea of microblogging.
Right.
The fact that either Google or Apple hasn't stepped in at this point and just stepped into the power vacuum that's being created is mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, it really speaks to how when you become a certain size megalopolis type corporation, you a little bit stop creating, and what you tend to start doing is buying out smaller companies. You know what I mean? And so
It wouldn't shock me, though, if Twitter really falls apart in the next couple of years, either Apple or Google or Facebook just buys them out and rolls them into their own family. So anyway, in the meantime, we'll keep plugging away, as Brad said, keeping the heart beating on Twitter with the hope that a future prince or princess will come along and save us from this terrible king.
Well, in the meantime, as we're all waiting for our prince or princess to come along, you can tell everyone that you're the coolest kid on your block because you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my traveling pal, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend, Dave Kellett, one of the few people to travel with me and still call me a friend, co-director of the comics documentary strip. It's you and Carolyn, Dave. That's pretty much it. And the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
I will call him a friend, but I will no longer call him a driver. I'll be Ubering everywhere from here on out. The Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net, and this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode like this one. This comes into Lisa, who we met over in Santa Rosa this past weekend, and Lisa says, I've been listening to your wisdom for a couple of years now, and I would like you to know what it's meant to me. As a teen, my father tried gently nudging me towards syndicated comics, but like a teen who knows everything, I gently did not go that route. I have spent most of my adult life failing to be a successful artist, and successful is in quotes. Success meaning making good money at it. I've always had a day job that did not define me while I continued to not make money with my art. This may sound harsh, but that was my mentality. I disappointed myself a lot and worried that I was disappointing my family and my friends. After recovering from breast cancer in my 40s, I decided to stop wasting my time, quote unquote, and really focus on becoming an illustrator of children's books. In hindsight, I think that turning towards kid lit might have been the creative person's equivalent of a midlife crisis. Several years into that goal, I was in a comic book store looking for a gift for my nephew, and I got my hands on I Hate Fairyland by Scotty Young. I was floored. I immediately loved it. I haven't read a comic book since I was probably 7. I'd never really been interested in comic books. Strips, yes, but books, no. Fairyland opened the floodgates and I dove in deep, researching, reading comics, and listening to Comic Lab. I couldn't shut up about maybe doing a comic, and my friend, who I'm sure was sick of hearing me talk about it, challenged me to do a one-pager. I did it and had a blast, so I decided to do a little bit longer. I worked week after week, month after month, working a day job, taking care of my family, and making my comic. Fast forward 11 months, I'm on the last page of my comic and starting the cover. And the whole time, I've been listening religiously to Comic Lab. You two have been with me on this journey. You have helped me make a good comic with your comics advice. But more importantly to me, you've helped me to be absolutely content and at peace with where I am in my life in regards to my art. I have found so much joy in every part of creating this comic thus far. I finally know what I'm supposed to be doing. And thanks to you and your wisdom, I don't mind anymore if I have to have a day job. That absolutely does not define me. I don't need to make money at this. I'm still going to do it. I don't need to prove myself to anyone. All I want to do is make comics. My father would be so happy. I'm forever grateful to you both for helping me see that I can find joy in this, even if no one sees it to myself. Not that I'm not going to try to sell the shit out of this, but if nobody's interested, I'll still be okay with that. I'm exactly where I need to be. Does that make you not feel absolutely wonderful or not?
My heart is full right now. Yeah. That is fantastic. And we had the very good fortune of meeting Lisa at the Schultz Museum this week. And Lisa, we thank you for traveling out to see the show. That meant the world to us. And you are a good egg. Thank you for this letter. I'm going to carry this through my whole week. My God, this is amazing. Yeah. So
isn't that wonderful?
Brad, the idea that the show is, I don't know, it sounds silly, but the idea that the show is working with people as they draw is delightful, and that makes my heart happy. So thank you, Lisa. Thank you, thank you. And I'm going to say Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab. So, Brad, now that I've seen you hop up into a raised Toyota Tacoma 4x4, which, my God, the beauty of a Russian ballet dancer. That was amazing. Now what I want to do is I want to do a talk with you on a dude ranch so that I can see you getting on a horse. I want to see Brad Geiger getting on a horse.
Oh, could you imagine me on a horse?
I need that in my life. I didn't know I needed it.
I've never, even in rural Michigan, we were considered, you know, city kids because we didn't live on an actual farm. I guarantee you I'd end up facing the wrong way on that horse. And there would be, it'd be a medical mystery. Two horses' asses.
Can I tell you, I've only ridden horses, I don't know, half a dozen times in my life. But here's the weird thing. Whenever you're riding a horse and you're like, you get to the pasture that you were heading to, and then you all kind of stop, you're in a group of five or six people. This is the weirdest feeling, and I shouldn't feel this, but I don't know how to stop it. Yeah. When your horse starts pooping when you're on it, you feel complicit. You feel like, I'm so sorry. I didn't know we were doing this now. I apologize to everyone.
Do you have to avert your eyes?
Yeah, you're like telling the other horse riders, no one look at me. No one look at my shame.